Coming up next on This Week in Computer Hardware, we want Oculus. Tegra gets Miracast, a 2,000-watt motherboard demo. The next-gen Xbox is for sale. And an easy home theater PC recipe. It's all coming up next on Twitch.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twitch.
Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, episode 180, recorded August 2nd, 2012. Oculus will change gaming. Welcome to Twitch, This Week in Computer Hardware, Twitch weekly show that does its best to bring you the best in exciting news for PC hardware and occasionally software. Actually, who am I kidding? We don't really care about software, except that you need software to do something useful with the PC hardware we love so much and the tablets that are growing on us each and every day. I am joined, as always, by Mr. Ryan Schrout, who is currently in Dallas.
That's correct. I'm in Dallas during a heat wave. Apparently, it's like 109 degrees out or something right now, or it was earlier today. So
you look like a PC shop.
That going for me.
You look like a PC shop in 1995 with stacks of boxes behind you.
Yeah. So I have tons of hardware behind me. I don't know how much of it's being caught in the video stream, but this is part of the prizing for our hardware workshop on Saturday here at QuakeCon, which is why I'm in Dallas. So QuakeCon 2012 is in Dallas. Our workshop is Saturday at 2 p.m. Central, which is 3 p.m. Eastern, noon Pacific. If you're in the area, definitely stop by. It's free. You can come in and register and go to any of the events and the panels and keynotes and that kind of stuff for free. BYOC is also free, but based on what I'm seeing now, it's completely full. So the actual LAN party of it is full up on Thursday night, which I don't think has happened in maybe like 10 years or something like that. So PC gaming is dying. I don't think that's the case. But yeah, otherwise, it's a great event. We'll be there. And if you can't be here in attendance, you can go to pcpro.com/workshop. And we have a list of all the prizes, some of the segments we're going to do, and we'll have a live stream set up as well Saturday for you to at least passively participate. Although you won't be able to scream and wave your hands in the air to get prizes thrown at you.
Woo!
You'll be able to virtually do that. And, you know, I don't know. Maybe it's fun for you. Maybe not. Either way, it's cool. It's definitely an event worth going to. It's free, tentative on, you know, whether or not you want to pay to reserve your space or all that kind of thing. But it had some down years recently, and I feel like it's picking back up. I mean, the fact that it's the first time the BYOC has sold out in maybe 10 years, and the fact that it did it on the very first day is a good sign.
A couple years ago, we had any money, right? Recession. You remember the recession. Yeah,
exactly. They were at the Hilton Anatel in Dallas, and they've done a really good job. Like, last 2 years we've had it here, it was kind of difficult to get food items delivered, right? These guys are looking for fast food type stuff. It was nothing real local. So they brought in like three local chains, and they have like giant semi-truck sized food trucks outside now kind of set up. So you never have to leave the property and that kind of deal. It's unique because it's an incredibly fancy, like high-end hotel with like 3,000 gamers camped out at their computers all night, all day and all night again. So it's
and
fun.
All day and all night. Interesting new technology coming from NVIDIA. They're looking to support, or they're not looking to. They've announced they are on board to support Miracast wireless display technology on the next generation of Tegra chipsets. It's interesting. If you're familiar with a short version of Miracast, is it allows you to take a device like a tablet, send video directly over Wi-Fi to a, in this case, Miracast-equipped television. This would be similar, but supposedly more open than Intel's WiDi technology, which is kind of the flag bearer in this area. Quote, devices right. will retain or require certification, much like other Wi-Fi routers and wireless adapters, writes Tim Vary on PCPer.com. The Miracast standard certification program is set to launch soon, with the standard specs published sometime in August. Any device manufacturer will be able to use a standard to go through certification, though whether or not we will see the high adoption rate that many are hoping for remains to be seen. And it looks like Tim points out that NVIDIA is going to be one of the first adopters of the Miracast standard by getting it into the Tegra 3 powered mobile devices using that 4+1 core system
right.
on the chip. So
not quad core anymore, 4+1.
4+1, that's like 5, but that's one better.
It's almost 5, but it's not quite. So it's interesting. I am still in love with this idea of the wireless display that doesn't require any external adapter on your TV, doesn't require any external adapter on your display device, whether it be a laptop or a tablet or a desktop computer even for that type of thing. But as he mentions kind of in the article, there's all kinds of competing technologies. You mentioned Intel's WiDi. You've got Apple's AirPlay, AMD's wireless display technology, and software versions like
external devices on your television end. AirPlay requires Apple TV or some other device or an AirPlay compatible receiver. WiDi requires the adapters. Right. I think this is a great idea. I'm with you. You know, I got to be honest. The Olympics has made AirPlay, you know, okay, occasionally I fire up a YouTube video on my phone or my tablet and I throw it on the Apple TV on the projector. But the Olympics was the first time I was ever really like AirPlay, because the Olympics, the AirPlay shows up on Mountain Lion OS 10 days before the Olympics launch. So I am actually able to, well, stuttering and stomping and being all NBC Universal about it, not to be cruel. But sending the video over AirPlay to the big screen so my son can watch the bicycles. And for the most part, it worked really well. I think AirPlay, you know, it's OS X Mountain Lion, AirPlay, Flash, and NBC Universal is a tough combination. I don't want to pin any blame on anybody in that chain prematurely. But it's tough because right now none of the HDTV manufacturers are making much in the way of cash. Everybody thinks like, oh, it's a $1,500 HDTV, but they're making the margins are so thin. The HDTV, the divisions of the HDTV divisions of most of the major consumer electronics companies are not making money. I think it's going to be really difficult, unless this is incredibly inexpensive, to see this integrated into televisions. It might be something that television manufacturers use to distinguish their televisions, but I wait with bated breath to see whether or not this shows up in the market anytime soon.
Still a little hopeful that we see like WHDI, wireless HDMI, kind of integrated on this kind of stuff as well. You know, these technologies, WiDi, AMD, AWD, you know, AirPlay, they have more functionality than simply an HDMI pass-through, right? Mm-hmm. Which is nice, but I think we need to... There's a lot of these standards out there. We just kind of need to get one, you know, where everybody can sort of adopt it, and we can get display and device matches fairly quickly.
I would like that. I am not holding my breath.
Agreed.
Well, no, think about it, right? We took 20 years to evolve a digital television technology, and we settled on 480i, 480p, 720i, 720p, 1080i, 1080p, and like three other variations on that theme. And then half the televisions for 2 years were shipping at a non-standard resolution anyway. So my faith in consumer electronics and settling on a good standard for the consumer completely broke. And if you think I'm full of it, take a look at the HD-DVD Blu-ray battle and get back to me on who's the most important one in that situation. Dude, this is ridiculous. Gigabyte Z77X UP7 delivers up to 2,000 watts of CPU power. Again, Tim Berry up on PCPer.com. Sometimes you see technology demonstrations and they are elegant, sophisticated, obviously dovetailing into years of evolution in a product category. And sometimes I think a vendor says, you know what? We're going to show you just how tough our product is and do something completely unhinged with it. Case in point, Gigabyte Z77X, they punched 2,000 watts of power through the LGA55 socket. Most importantly, without frying it.
Always good, yes. If you're going to make a demonstration of things, please don't break the parts.
I mean, you know, this is all about demonstrating the power phase, the VRM hardware on board. Where is it? And the 40 power phases. What is going on?
32 power phases. So, right, I mean, it's really just a demonstration. Make sure everybody we're super clear about that. We're not telling anybody that they will ever run 2,000 watts through,
if you run,
you know,
I was going to say, if you run 2,000 watts into any processor that is currently sold in the world for an 1155 right. socket, you will explode the chip off the sockets.
So they had 837 total amps
Yeesh.
Of power at 2.42 volts, right? And so you do the math and you get somewhere around 2,000 watts of power. They claim that this would be enough power to support 25 Core i7-3770K processors. And as Tim says, would also easily allow you to permanently destroy your CPU, putting that Intel overclocking warranty to the test. It's, you know, this motherboard battles that we get into between Asus right. and MSI and Gigabyte, between who makes the best products, who has the best features, who has the best stability. You know, you get into this like super high overclocking, who has the highest frequencies. And you know, you'd be surprised how much it goes back and forth. Or, you know, Gigabyte can make this claim about 2,000 watts of power for a CPU, but they don't hold the highest clock speed for Ivy Bridge CPUs Asus does, or something like that, right? So it's marketing spin. It's cool demonstration. You know, you can watch the video that we're showing here on the video version of Twitch as well, or you can see on the PC Per page that we've embedded it in. And, you know, they try to prove that they have the number one motherboard for CPU power delivery, right? Which right. may be the case.
And, you know,
that's all I can say, I guess, right? Yeah.
It's not something you're ever going to test in normal use, at least.
I will not be, that's for sure.
But it's nice to know the relatively tame requirements of your processor that are like 1/20th of what they did in this demo should yep. not kill it. More GTI 660 Ti rumors confirmed by leaked review. What's the story, man?
So another review site actually posted a full review of a NVIDIA GeForce GTX 660 Ti. So, you know, we've talked about some of the leaks specifications before, and now the leaks of this review actually more or less confirm those specifications and the pricing, right? So the review claims that it will have 1,344 CUDA cores, 2 gigs of memory, both the same as the GTX 670 available today. The only difference being the 192-bit memory controller instead of the 256-bit memory controller, right? Mm-hmm. And if you go hunt down that review, you'll see that the, you know, performance delta between the 660 Ti and the 670 is fairly modest, especially considering we're talking about a $100 price gap, right? And this is the same thing we talked about last week when I was in studio, was like, if these specs turned out to be true and the pricing rumors turned out to be true, the 660 Ti could be a really, really sweet card. And that looks more and more like it's going to be the case, right? So obviously it's still not officially launched, so anything can be up in the air and be changed at this point. But this kind of early released review, you know, non-NDA type review, seems to have pretty substantial evidence behind it.
Interesting. Also, usually means somebody's going to get kicked in the tush somewhere along the pipe.
Right.
Although at this point, everybody kind of knows this is coming, so there's probably a lot of parts out there yep. that could have been leaked. Dango Durango, the next-gen Xbox developer kit cited in the wild. Scott Michaud wrote this up. Is it Michaud?
Yes, Scott Michaud? That is correct. Good job.
Eurogamer Digital Foundry believe that a next-generation Xbox developer kit somehow, speaking of leaks, got into the hands of an internet user looking to fence it for $10,000 if the rumors are true. And this is pretty unhinged, right? Because Microsoft doesn't even want to admit that the 720 is on its way, because I don't think they want to cannibalize Xbox 360 sales, especially in the light right. of the incredible Kinect success. You know, they're possibly they're turning the Xbox into this digital home entertainment center. It's one of the sort of the really popular things going on the Xbox, which makes me wonder, are they going to actually try to change the interface to match the interface they're using on every other Microsoft device out there? A little PC perspective on console gaming news. Quote, says Scott, if the source and people who can corroborate it are telling the truth, somehow Microsoft lost control of a single developer's kit for their upcoming Xbox platform, much like their Cupertino frenemies who lost an iPhone 4 in a bar which was taken and sold for $5,000 to a tech blog. The current owner of the Durango dev kit is looking for a buyer for a mere $10,000. It is unlikely he found it on a bar stool, unquote. This
no,
is
likely not. Know,
Yeah, I mean, basically, it's doubtful if this looks like what the final version is going to look like. It's probably operating systems just barely running. You know, Scott points out that the first Xbox 360 software dev kits were running on Apple Mac Pros. I think it's going to be really interesting to see, what's going on with this. It's kind of funny, like, quote, PC gamers might want to pay close attention from this point on. Contrast the switch from Xbox to PowerPC to x86 with a recent commentary from Gabe Newell and Rob Pardo of Blizzard. As Mike's Caps is alluded to, prior to the launch of the Unreal Tournament 3, Epic is concerned about the console mindset coming to the PC. It is entirely possible that Microsoft could be positioning the Xbox platform closer to the PC. Perhaps there are plans for cross-compatibility in exchange for closing the platform around certification and licensing fees. You know, and this is interesting. This is similar to some of the news we've seen on the Apple side of the fence, because I think, you know, we talked about it on Techzilla, where Apple, you know, Apple's like, hey, you want to pay $60, you get the operating system on a disc. You want to pay $20, you download it through the App Store. By the way, when you install Mountain Lion, it's going to have Gatekeeper put up. What's Gatekeeper do? Mm-hmm. Prevents you from installing non-certified software. And I think Apple most definitely wants to lock down, wants a walled garden iOS style on what you install. Microsoft is probably moving in that direction. There are security reasons for wanting to do that. But it also does things like maybe put them in a position to lock out open source software on your computer, right? To put on my tinfoil hat, get a little bit freaky. But the idea, it's interesting that, wow, if they smush together development for the PC and the Xbox 360, that means that the PC could potentially be limited to the Xbox 360 specs or the Xbox 360 next generation, which are going to sound great at launch, but after a couple of years are going to seem really slow. It's going to get messy. I think that's what Scott is alluding to in his article.
I would agree.
But this is also a box found by somebody somewhere in Europe that may be real but might not be real, and it's too darn early to know what relationship it's going to make to the actual shipping devices. So there are uncertainties.
To say the least. In the spirit of QuakeCon, we had a story of a new mouse from Thermaltake called the Black Element Cyclone Edition. And the Cyclone Edition means that it comes with a fan that mounts on the front of the mouse. So where Thermaltake mouse stands out is a micro USB port on the front right side of the mouse and its accompanying peripheral. A small fan attachment plugs into the mouse to cool your hand during long gaming sessions. They are claiming 2.7 CFM cubic feet per minute at 6,000 RPM and 21.7 dB. For those that get sweaty palms during long work hours or gaming sessions, this looks like an interesting design. Fans removable, making it portable. You know, if you take it with you, that maybe doesn't break, is super easy. I had seen some of these at Computex events, and the idea is always fairly intriguing, as long as it, I don't know, there's something kind of hokey about it. You know, it's like
it looks like something you would pick up at a computer fair or at that computer store that has all of the peculiar computer accessories. It looks a little hokey. Is that a cruel word, hokey?
No, it doesn't. I mean, you're right. It looks like, but it seems like such a good idea. Like, we've got 2,800 people in the BYOC here in Dallas. It's 109 degrees outside. They're going to have sweaty hands. They're going to be using a mouse for 8 or more hours a day straight. And I think the idea of having a fan to cool down your hand, you know, it take some of the sweat off of the mouse itself. Maybe you wear down the finish of the mouse buttons and that kind of thing a little bit better. It kind of makes sense.
Okay,
but you know, you got to see if it, like, do
plus
you just
you can
look,
customize
look,
the
do you look like a goofball?
You're playing. Who doesn't look like a goofball? With how many people do you look at playing video games and
that's
think,
true.
"Wow, they look suave and sophisticated"? I want to look just like them when I'm playing Quake. You know what I'm saying?
Yes.
On the subject of mice, we also have a link to Ars Technica, who went hands-on with Microsoft's new tablet-oriented keyboard and mouse. Casey Johnson Johnston up at ArsTechnica.com. I am not sold on the design of the Wedge Touch Mouse.
It is literally a wedge, like an inverted block of cheese you drop your hand over with a round edge. The keyboard looks like an even smaller version of some reasonably good Microsoft keyboards that exist. Casey says, quote, the wedge keyboard is the better thought out product of the two, which is damning with faint praise. Compact keyboard, full-size keys, Windows 8 hotkeys. The killer feature is a silicone rubberized cover that can both protect the keyboard and be folded along a seam to use as a tablet stand. That is actually really cool. The tablet, that thing you, behind the sort of see-through tablet in that picture, was the cover that snaps onto the keyboard. The wedge mouse is going to be too small for most people's hands. This is like the classic sort of portable Microsoft mouse, 2.39 by 2.11 inches, so it's wider than the classic Microsoft portable mouse. Tapered triangular edge, that wedge of cheese with a silver size over the edge, two standard keys for clicking, quote, and its large flat top surface is touch sensitive, allowing users to one finger scroll up, down, left, and right, which is kind of cool, but it won't support multi-touch gestures, so... Yeah, you know, I think the Microsoft Sculpt Touch Mouse, I've used the something similar to the Sculpt Mobile Keyboard, which is farther down on that page. Microsoft makes some good peripherals, but that wedge mouse just, that just looks like a triumph of design over substance.
original IntelliMouse. We had one out just recently. Oh, we were doing that Windows 98 system build, right? We were talking about it there. Laser eye based, you know, like kind of the first ones that weren't ball based mice, as well. Still the best mouse. Just like many people would claim that IBM still makes the best keyboards.
Hey man, don't be dissing IBM keyboards. Corsair Vengeance. Lano C has been busily working their way through Corsair's Vengeance series of gaming peripherals, writes Jeremy Hellstrom up at PCPer.com with a link to the article. They start off with the K60 and K90, both mechanical keyboards, speaking of IBM keyboards. So Corsair's K60 and K90 mechanical keyboards using Cherry MX red switches. Very nice switches, I must say, with customizable red rubber WASD buttons with a slant on them to make your fingers more comfortable for long nights of first-person shooter action. The K90 has three rows of six programmable buttons on the left side, making the keyboard even wider, which is kind of exciting. And then they also have a couple of gaming mice. And at this point, you know, gaming mice, kind of awkwardly shaped, kind of have a scroll button, have customizable buttons, probably some throw weights underneath there. Gaming mice just seem to be... I find it difficult to find a gaming mice that I find comfortable.
It is a very preferential component, definitely.
They hurt me to look at. Apparently, I want the soft touch of the traditional Microsoft IntelliMouse.
I've used both these mice. They're actually really nice. We actually have a review coming on pretty soon, but... I forget which one. Is it the M... I think it's the M90, the one that has, like... 9 buttons around the thumb for it. That's too many buttons for me. I can't deal with 9 hotkey buttons on the keyboard. Yeah, that's more my style. Exactly. Is there a 1 and a 2 in the middle? Done. Okay. But on the Corsair KM60, it has like the sniper button, which kind of temporarily lowers the DPI. So like while you're trying to be more accurate with your mousing and stuff like that. And it's not useful just for... gaming, but I actually use that mouse pretty much on an everyday basis. And like when you're using Photoshop or Premiere and you're trying to, you know, select something very specifically, it can be nice to have that button lower the DPI and, you know, get a little bit more precise mousing with it.
Right. Speaking of slightly terrifying gaming mice, check out Razer's new $129 or pounds. Standardized pricing, $129 USD, $129.99.
Sorry, guys.
Or euros in Europe. The Ouroboros, wired or wireless, quote, 12-hour battery life, the ambidextrous design. Tim Berry writes that users can adjust the length of the mouse as well as the angle of the back arch. It's got all these different snap-in components, two side panels for each side, four total that can be switched out to make it right-handed or left-handed. It's interesting. So it's like a cousin to the, or a grandchild to the Mamba. 4G dual sensor technology boasts up to 8,200 DPI resolution. Wireless mode, the Ouroboros features a 1 millisecond response time and a claimed 1,000 hertz polling rate, powered by a single AA battery.
LED lighting, the right mouse buttons, a scroll wheel, dedicated DPI switching buttons, or the sniper button, as Ryan likes to call it.
Yes.
$130.
Man, I can't get behind. $130 for a mouse is just crazy.
But this is cool a looking. Superior gaming mouse.
I'm in. It says superior right in the name.
Inch of okay, so neither one of us. You know what? What we need to do is game head-to-head, right? Actually, we need to get real gamers in.
Yeah, there you go. Okay, that's a better
idea. Let's get a bunch of real gamers, like professional gamers in. Because it's not like you can secretly swap. We've substituted the $129 Ouroboros gaming mouse that insert name of professional gamer here normally uses for a standard $15 Microsoft IntelliMouse. Let's see if he gets his delete expletive fragged as soon as he enters the gaming arena. You know what I mean? It would be interesting to see if you can actually quantify your success in a full-on first-person
shooter. I'm sure professional gamers do, you know, try these types of things out. Anything that can kind of give them the most minor of edge in those types of gaming. But I also know that just like other athletes and sports players, they find something they like and they want to stick with it, and they're very hesitant to change as well. So. Lots of interesting mice out there. I saw one from Asus that looked like straight out of the Transformers movies that had so many moving parts on it that I was afraid to like even attempt to adjust anything. Like you could adjust width, length, and all kinds of weird things, like all with little dials and tiny screwdriver adjustments and stuff.
If it looks like a 19th century medical instrument, it's not really making me want to grab it with the hand I write with and start, you know, gaming. Seagate. Quote, that Seagate is, lets
a good analogy.
Yeah, just, you know, some of the gaming mice I look at, and I'm like, wow. You know, they look like Reavers machines. Seagate lets you guess the SSD manufacturer wants to buy. The CFO of Seagate, Pat O'Malley, Scott Michaud writes, is looking to purchase a solid-state drive manufacturer, but will not confirm rumors that OCZ is who they have in mind, and then acknowledge that there is only one company who would make sense for them to acquire. This is from a Reuters article. The short answer is the CFO at Seagate wants to be in, or Seagate wants to be in, the incredibly exciting SSD market. And the easiest way for them to do that, of course, is to buy an existing SSD manufacturer. So Chief Financial Officer Pat O'Malley said the company... Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
It's funny because the CFO said the company would be interested in buying an SSD maker that has a significant share of the enterprise market, says Reuters. Quote, O'Malley said, we look at all the technology product providers for merger and acquisition, but what I would say is that on the enterprise SSDs, there's probably only one of them really makes any significant money, unquote. That was in response to a question about Seagate's interest in OCZ technology. So
It's interesting. So they haven't mentioned any company by name. And while most people in the industry are assuming that they're talking about OCZ, I think one of the commenters and that Brett mentions on our site, hey, he thinks they're talking about Fusion IO, right? And here's, it depends on what Seagate wants to do. If Seagate wants to become an SSD player just in general, you know, they can buy OCZ and they'll get very strong consumer market.
Right.
But they're going to have a growing, I'll call it, enterprise market, right? So they don't have a huge market share now, but they're definitely making strides in that area. That's where the company as a whole trying to push. And but if you look at Fusion IO, it's only ever really been targeted at the enterprise market. And it's kind of curious because he talks about, you know, there's only one company that's making a lot of money in the enterprise world right now. And I'm not smart enough to know if Fusion IO is making a lot of money or they're losing a lot of money, or if OCZ is making a lot of money at the enterprise market or not. So I think there's a couple of different options here, even though our story and most of the stories on this are basically saying OCZ is going to get bought by Seagate. A lot of people predicted it would be announced on July 30th or July 31st. That obviously didn't happen. But it's interesting, right? OCZ is this... I think they are ripe for that type of acquisition. They've gotten out of memory market for the most part. They're kind of they're emphasizing only solid state technology in terms of their portfolio. They still have power supplies, but they're not really pushing them, not really talking about them. And in terms of setting themselves up for an acquisition, they're definitely the company that I feel like is doing that as well. But Fusion.io could be like that too, right? I mean, this is how these hot technology startups kind of work, right? Do they ever think they take the majority market share from somebody like Intel if they wanted to do it? Maybe not. But hey, if Seagate comes around and says, hey, we have a couple of $1 billion that we'd like to throw at you, then everybody listens.
So, yeah, I don't know. It'll be interesting to see if it turns out. I don't know if OCZ has the enterprise market share that the CFO from Seagate keeps hammering on. Ryan mentioned the PC Perspective Hardware Workshop 2012, a QuakeCon 2012 in Dallas, Texas. It's taking place August 2nd through 5th. The main stage is where Ryan's going to be Saturday, August 4th, 2 p.m. Central Time. There's information on that up at pcper.com/workshop. And we should take a moment. We love your questions. Last week, because we were getting down and dirty with cooling devices, we didn't do too many questions. We're going to try to make up for it today. If you want to email us, twitch@twit.tv. If you're not normally watching the show, I feel pain in my heart, but I can fix that. You can fix the pain in my heart by going to twit.tv/twitch or subscribing through iTunes, iTunes, or whatever your favorite podcatcher is. Victor writes in for our first question of the day. Hi, Sir Patrick and Sir Brian.
Hold on. I want to bring up something this week. We have a little bit of time.
I'm so sorry.
I'm sorry. I snuck this in at the. Have you heard about this Oculus stuff yet?
I have now.
Okay.
Yeah, you know, so
the head-mounted VR kit. It's the very first day of QuakeCon. Not much has happened. We've only ever jumped out, and I think it went on for 4 hours or something like that. The guy just books of information flow out of it. Right.
So we have the biggest 3D push. Rendering. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, this is if you remember at E3, I don't know if we talked about it in that time frame. Carmack was demoing a head-mounted VR display that he built that had like Oakley goggles and specific cameras built into it, and he had duct tape, kind of connecting it in certain places. Well, this company that he, kind of built his prototype out of, dev kits from, is now started a Kickstarter to create development kits, better looking hardware, you buy it, you get the software, and that kind of stuff. And what's really, really interesting, first of all, it made a ton of money. Its goal was $250,000 and it made over $1 million in the first like day and a half. And so one of the cool things about it is that at QuakeCon this year, they're actually demoing this technology to anybody that wants to see it. You can go into the booth area, you can try on the headset, you can try it out, and get hands-on time with these types of prototypes and this technology. And we're talking about a head-mounted VR display. So you get stereoscopic 3D because there's one screen in front of each eye. And it's the technology where you lift your head up, and your character looks up. You look to the left, and you look left. You look to the right, and so on. And that's the benefit of a head tracked display, right? So you still have to, you still have to use a keyboard to walk forward and walk backwards and that kind of stuff, and mouse around for your cursor. But John Carmack specifically coded the new Doom 3 BFG edition to work with these VR with this VR display. So that's what they're demoing here this week. And it's technology. Like, I think he probably talked for 2 hours about this technology. And he's super excited about it.
I want this to work. I want this really badly to work, because this is the first time, every time I've seen sort of 3D gaming or this gaming or that gaming or immersive gaming helmets, it's always almost invariably involved a horrible experience. And if Carmack's excited about it, it should be good. I'm really curious what the real world resolution is going to be, because so many of these devices. $275 for the assemble it yourself kit, $300
or $300 if you want to get pre-configured. It's almost an, if you're a hardware guy, it's almost an impulse buy at this point, right? It's like, just for $300
buy without like, kids. It's almost an impulse buy.
$100 on a new display, easy. And so now you're not just talking about a display, you're talking about a whole new display technology, right? And so if when you get Gabe Newell, who's quoted in this Kickstarter of saying, we'd strongly encourage you to support this Kickstarter, you know, it starts to look like, you know, this isn't going to be everywhere. It's going to be really cool technology. It's going to be one of those differentiating factors, again, between PCs and consoles and what they can do. And it's, you know, they're saying estimated delivery of December 2012. So it's not like it's a year out or something like that. We're talking about, you know, 4 months or less.
Yeah, I don't want to
sound, you actually get your hands on this.
This is the most backing from real gaming, like real game. It's kind of funny because, like, right. We've seen this stuff before. This is one of the first time you've seen some of these sort of the industry leaders in terms of pushing the technology of gaming really get excited about one of these. Anything you strap to your face and look through. I certainly am not excited about 3D gaming on an HDTV.
Sure.
I really want this to, I'm serious. I really want this to work. I really want it to be a relatively high resolution experience. I don't want somebody to be like, it's like looking at a 50-inch HDTV and give me like a CUSIF screen inside of
love
it.
Love those SkyMall ads.
Yeah, and I got to say, they have the backing for it. Boom. You know, they were looking for $250,000. They've got over $1 million. I would really love to see this happen. You know, I don't think I have $300 to drop on it, but I'll see if I can get one of my younger coworkers drunk and to whip out their credit card and sign up for it so we can get it on Texas as early as possible.
Did you? You asked about resolution, right? It's. Yeah. I did. Actually, I met the career. Creator today, and I told him actually on my drive to QuakeCon, I read about this Kickstarter and had already given him $300 for this device. So he kind of laughed and said, "Well, now you can actually come back to the booth tomorrow and demo it and take a look."
Dude, you got to come on and talk. Come on, Techzilla next week and talk about experience with Oculus.
Absolutely, I'd love to do it. I'm excited. I'm excited to see it. You know, I mean, it's still developer kit. You know, it's 640 by 800. Resolution per eye. So I mean it's not like this is the end game, but this is like the first step.
You're excited.
A pretty interesting change in displays.
I know you've got a hard out at 7 o'clock. Do we have time to fit one question in?
Yeah, we can do a couple questions. Yeah, sure.
Do Victor or Zach?
Let's do both. We can do these both.
Victor emails in, "Hi, Sir Patrick and Sir Ryan, love the show. Thanks for reading this question. I want to build a home theater PC, or I think I do. Here's the goal, to have a low-powered PC in the living room next to my HDTV where my media will be stored, mostly movies, and have it connected to the home network, but not have a Blu-ray player on it because my gaming rig will do its magic and rip it in its full quality and store it on the home theater PC through the network. Now, I have more than one question. Is this possible? Yes. If so, how? Windows Media Center, Handbrake, any DVD, or any DVD decryptor? And my last question is, where do I find info on how to build this machine? And I'll note that my budget will be $400. Man, build a Core i3 or a Core i4 with, 3,000 or 4,000 graphics. Build a standard PC. 4 gigabytes of RAM will be enough. You don't need a lot of power. Yeah. Everything you need is basically in an inexpensive Core i3 motherboard and chip. Throw 4 gigabytes of RAM on top of it, run Windows Media Center, and you're basically done. The ripping and encoding is another story. We can get into it another time. But essentially, you don't need a whole lot of PC to build this. Your biggest issue is making sure you don't sort of, you know, your biggest issue, because it's going to be next to the HDTV, is making sure you put a decent power supply on it that doesn't have a big screaming fan, and to make sure you spend the $50 to get a gigantic air cooler that's going to be like 20 dB at the operating temperatures you're going to see when you're running a movie. Because you don't want to be like watching a movie and every time the action stops and the dramatic dialogue begins, you're going, gee whiz, my home theater PC is loud. Like, that's the biggest challenge of the home theater PC, if it's in the media totem by the screen, is making sure it's super quiet. In terms of processor and motherboard and graphics, you know, onboard graphics is fine. A Core i3 will do it. A Core i5 will give you some legs. 4 gigabytes of RAM will be more than enough. Throw a copy of Windows 7 on it. Fire up Windows Media Center. Configure it. You're done.
he's got the perfect scenario for a basic home theater PC. And I think you're right. You know, there are tons of different hardware options for something like that.
You know, potato remote. I mean, the remote control stuff is probably the most challenging part. You can either use a, you know, $25 Windows Center remote, or you can use one of the really interesting tools that are showing up on iPhone and Android. One last one, email from Zach, who says, I've been listening for several weeks and keep waiting for someone to ask this question. Since no one else will do it, then I suppose I will have to. With all of the advancements on the onboard side of Ivy Bridge graphics, is there a way to harness that size when using a discrete graphics card? I can imagine three options. One, the onboard graphics processor switches to CPU processors when the onboard graphics are disabled. Two, the onboard graphics could act as a pseudo SLI to aid in GPU processing. Three, the onboard graphics could be used to power a screen with web pages, Ventrilo, etc., while using the discrete graphics card for maximum performance on a gaming monitor. In the last 10 years of computer building, I have never considered any of these options. It's exciting to see the advancements that Intel has put in. I just hope I can use it. I really enjoy the show. Keep up the good work. Zach.
This technology already exists. This is Lucid, right? This is, you can't do number three. You can do one and two. You can do onboard graphics and switch the CPU processor, you know, when the discrete GPU is disabled. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you can't really do a pseudo SLI with integrated discrete unless you're talking stuff with low-end discrete. You can't couple Intel with all the other stuff. So you can do it in the fact of take advantage of the best features of both graphics processors without really messing anything up, right? So that's good.
it's kind of funny. I mean, look, the truth is if you're running a 1080p monitor, which is almost everybody watching right now, you have more GPU. Okay, discrete graphics, not so much. But if you have a GPU that was designed and marketed and released in the last year or two, you have a lot of 3D power, and it's if you're in 2D, yep. If you're not gaming, a second monitor isn't going to tax that. 2D, even the we're kind of spoiled with the amount of GPU power that we have. I think it'll be interesting to see if at some point Intel decides to figure out a way, or AMD for that matter, to sort of do background graphic processing on the secondary panel so you can have your Twitter
Lucid feed. Lucid claims to do that kind of stuff too. They claim that the integrated graphics can support, you know, aids in performance. I think they call it like high performance. HYPERFORMANCE. Not a great name, but they claim some that can do it, and it kind of helps improve responsiveness of gaming, not really frame rates in the same way. It's a really tricky kind of subject, but if you check out some of the articles on Lucid's MVP software suite, you'll get a good idea of all that stuff. So
there you have it. Ladies and gentlemen, we have to wrap. Mr. Ryan Shrout has a pressing engagement this evening that may or may not involve him continuing to be happily married, so we're going to get him out the door as quickly as possible. We love your email, Twitch, twich@twit.tv. Do us a favor, if you like the show, if you got some geeky friends out there that like computer hardware, send them to us. And if you don't know where to find us, and I don't know how you found us if you don't know where to find us, it's twitch.tv/twitch, or subscribe to us on iTunes or your favorite podcatcher. I'm Patrick Norton.
I'm Ryan Shrout.
We'll see you next week on Twitch.